Felt Radio is brought to you by BoonRidge.com, the home of adventure.
With a plan to expand my vision. Yeah, it's either this or it's prison. I'm trying to be free and expand my wisdom. I gotta tell my story. I did it for the journey, the glory. Many men tried way before me. I had to do it bigger cause I had to make history. From the street.
Hello and welcome to Ocean Research Project. I am Matt Rutherford, sitting on my boat in Annapolis, Maryland. How you guys doing? So, another hurricane. Rather incredible. Comes through, rips up Dominica, slams into St. Croix. I mean, that's really tough for the Virgin Islands, because St. Croix didn't get that badly hit in Irma. I mean, it got hit, but it was acting as like the relief station for St. John and St. Thomas, and now it's hit. So, yeah, now all the Virgin Islands, all the U.S. Virgin Islands, and the British Virgin Islands from Irma, everything is trashed. Just a really, really horrible situation for the relief effort. And then, of course, goes in and plows into Puerto Rico, which is... just makes it that much worse. It makes it worse for the Virgin Islands because Puerto Rico was also helping, the U.S. Virgin Islands trying to get supplies and whatnot and food. And so it was like the last little base for resupplying. And now it's hit. I can't imagine the entire island out of power. I mean, isn't that just crazy? Like the whole, Puerto Rico is not a small island. And there are, like, millions and millions of people that live on it. I could easily imagine if, like, a few towns got their power knocked down, or I could imagine if, like, one-third of the island, maybe. But for the entire island, I mean, the entire country of Puerto Rico has no power, and is not going to have power for as long as 6 months from now. I mean, I certainly hope for their sake it isn't 6 months. They've been having some real hard economic times. I've actually delivered quite a few boats to Puerto Rico to people who've gotten recently rich. And these are always, they're typically white people, Americans, who are in Puerto Rico flipping houses. There's a lot of money to be made in Puerto Rico buying old beat-up houses and fixing it up and flipping them. And because so many people are broke, I guess there's a lot of houses available to be flipped. I don't know who's buying the houses. I have no idea. But I've delivered nice boats several times down to people who are in that line of occupation in the last few years. Sort of taking advantage of the... I don't know. I mean, can you really blame them? I guess. I mean, if there's a dollar to be made, it's not like they're hurting anybody. They are definitely profiting off the situation. But I don't know. I mean, Puerto Rico should probably just be a state by this point, really. I mean, the Puerto Ricans fight in our military. I mean, just that by itself should be enough to give them, you know, to make them a state. If Puerto Rico was full of white people, it would have been a state a long time ago. I'm not trying to make some racial thing, but you know it. You know it as well as I do. If Puerto Rico was full of white people, it would already have been a state. So, I mean, just make it a state. Why not? Our 51st state. Should just make the Virgin Islands states too, the U.S. Virgins. I mean, I can work there without a work visa. Someone in Puerto Rico can work in the United States. Just, you know, they need help. They all need help. And they would get that much more assistance if they, if they were a state. It is interesting how people in some places voted against Hurricane Sandy relief are now voting for Hurricane Harvey relief. Interesting how your opinion changes when it's your part of the world, or your part of the country, I should say, that's getting hit. But, you know, hypocrisy is deeply rooted in politics. It's deeply rooted in all of us. We're all hypocrites at some level. You know, the hypocrisy lives within us all at some level. But, and politicians seem to thrive off of it or something. But anyways, enough about that. I did want to get into a little more about hurricanes and understanding hurricanes and climate change. So, since 1970, 1971, when we really started monitoring hurricanes and typhoons in any real way, about 10,000 people die every single year globally from hurricanes and typhoons. About $7 billion worth of damages annually worldwide. And about a third, the global population that is threatened by hurricanes has tripled. And that's because more people are living near the water, especially in the United States. I get it. It's nice to live by the water. You know, it's nice. It's nice to live on. That's why waterfront is expensive. Hell, I wouldn't mind. You know, I've been cheating for a long time because I've been living on sailboats a long time. I got waterfront property living on a sailboat and paying a whole lot less. But yeah, okay, waterfront's nice. I get it. But you know, there's sort of been, in the United States, it's sort of been bad policy for building in hurricane zones because it's really, the damages are being subsidized by people who don't live in the hurricane zones. So those people who choose to live in places with a lot of hurricane activity that's very pretty and tropical or whatever else, when the hurricane comes plowing through, who's the people who bails them out and gives them the money to fix everything back up again? It's the people who are not living in the hurricane zones. So if you're just looking at a hurricane, really a hurricane is more of a water event than a wind event. Now, I know that seems like a really strange thing to say. And of course, the wind is what kicks up the water. So obviously that's important. But if you look at what is doing the most damage, not just to property, but also to human lives, more people die from drowning in a hurricane than by wind. You know, it's like triple or quadruple. And believe it or not, more people die from freshwater, drowning in freshwater, than drowning in saltwater. I guess it's because of the rain. You know, I guess rivers overflow and dams burst and all this other stuff. But more people are actually killed by freshwater than anything else during a hurricane. So you have like a 75% chance, if you're going to die in a hurricane, you have like a 75% chance of drowning and maybe like a 25% chance of getting killed by something wind related. So, and most of the damages that happen are related to flood damage, not wind damage. I mean, wind, you look at Tortola and places like that where you have 185 knots and 190 knots. Obviously, that's a different world. I mean, that's like, that's almost as strong as a tornado. That's just going to, the wind will destroy everything. But if you look at a more normal hurricane, category 1, category 2, category 3, the wind is definitely going to do damage where the eye, where the epicenter rolls through. But in the greater scale, it's really the water that's doing the damage. So historically, we don't really know much before 1943. Any hurricanes or typhoons before 1943 were just stuff that was reported by ships, and it's very loose information. And actually, when you compare it to what we know now, it doesn't look that far off. But we had no satellites. We had no great way of looking for hurricanes. So in 1943, they started to do air reconnaissance, flying airplanes, especially in the North Atlantic. The North Atlantic is by far the most well-known area for hurricanes. So they start doing air reconnaissance, but they're not going to see every single hurricane, right? I mean, they're going to miss some of them. So 1958 came around, and they invented a machine that can measure wind speeds from airplanes. It was actually invented at MIT. And so starting in 1958, they could actually fly these planes into hurricanes and determine the wind speed. 1970 is when everything changed. They created something called a scatomonitor. And, they started detecting it in 1970 with satellites. They started using satellites. And that made a big difference. And it was really 1978 when the scatomonitor came in. And that was the first quantitative measurements for looking at wind speed using a satellite. So it really, really big time game changer. And they just launched a new version of the scatomonitor using radiation somehow that also measures basically wind speed and so on from satellites. This is all relatively new. So using historic hurricane data to try to look, understanding climate change is all about long-term trends. It's not about a single hurricane. It's not about a single summer or winter. It's about long-term trends. So it's really hard for us to have accurate data before 1970. Now, that's still 47 years ago. We got 47 years of data. But before 1970, a hurricane could have slipped through the cracks here and there. Although we had pretty good data, I think we probably got most of it. We probably have most of the information we need. And if you look at a graph from 1850, when they first started getting ship data, to around 1990, it mostly is the same. It's a scale. It goes up, it goes down, it goes up, it goes down. But it, generally speaking, it stays within the same parameters. Around the mid-1990s to late 1990s, you can see an increase in the activity of hurricanes, both in the amount of hurricanes and also in the strength of the hurricanes. And it really sort of goes off the charts, to be honest. But is that enough? Is that enough proof? I mean, we got 47 years, and we have an increase starting in the mid to late 1990s, but I really wish we had another 100 years of data we could back that up with. And I know in some ways we do have that data from air reconnaissance and from, you know, what other ships have recorded. You know, people, merchant ships in the Navy has been pretty good about recording, the temperatures and wind speeds and so on. But that doesn't mean enough for science. Remember, you can't prove anything with one data set. You got to have like 5 data sets, 10 data sets, 500 data sets, 1,000,000 data sets. You know, you need to have a lot of data to prove or disprove something as complicated as, is man having effect on climate change? Is man having effect on hurricanes? Is man-made climate change affecting hurricanes? You know, these are very, very complex issues. So what do we know? What else do we know? Besides, there's been this spike since the mid to late 1990s. Hurricanes are reaching peak intensity at higher latitudes. So there is something called paleotempestology. And what this is paleotempestology means you're measuring sand distribution. So what this, and sand distribution particularly related to storm activity. So basically you got a storm and you got a bunch of sea surge and it pushes a bunch of sand from the beach further and further inshore depending on how strong it is. And a hurricane is going to push the sand from the beach really far inshore. So what happens is people go and they get a sand core. It's this kind of the similar thing to people getting an ice core. They take this device, they lower it down through the sand, they get this big core, has all these different layers in it, and each layer is a representation of different activity that's happened year after year after year, going back hundreds and hundreds of years. So, and they take this sand core, they use carbon dating, they carbon date the layers, and see what's been happening. So they've been doing this for some time now in 4 different areas, north to south, or let's say south to north, okay? Belize, Jamaica, Puerto Rico, Bermuda. So, okay, Belize is the furthest south, Bermuda is the furthest north. So they have been looking at these areas, and what they have found in these sand cores is that over time, hurricanes have been going further and further north. That the sand distribution that they're finding, there's higher rates of it further north. So basically, there is a trend, a general long-term trend, that hurricanes are reaching higher latitudes and also having a peak intensity at higher latitudes. So why is that happening? Well, they follow warm water. So if it's warmer, they're able to go further north. And, so we know that much. We know that hurricanes are making it further north than they used to. We have a somewhat of a data set saying that we do know that since the mid to late 1990s, there's been more hurricanes and they've been stronger. But really, truthfully, there's that whole data, you know, considering we started in 1970, we don't, I don't know, it's sort of difficult, but we do know that they have been heading, they've been moving further north. We also know, starting in 1980, they started measuring trends in thermodynamic activity. And what they've noticed since 1980 is, what they've found is that the intensity of thermodynamic activity has increased by about 3 meters per second every decade, which is about 3 knots. So thermodynamics, that's, you know, warmer air goes up and colder air goes down, and high pressures and low pressures, warm fronts meeting cold fronts, you know, all this stuff that's happening in our atmosphere that causes storms, it causes doldrums, it causes rain, everything. The thermodynamic activity itself, all of this happening, all of this activity within thermodynamics is increasing by roughly 3 knots every decade since 1980. And as these forces continue to move faster, it's only going to increase the chances that it's going to create storm activity, whether it's a storm in the North Atlantic or a hurricane or a typhoon or whatever it is. And this increase is happening about 4,000 miles north and south of the equator. So about an 8,000-mile band wrapping around our planet, which would encompass the United States, Western Europe, Russia, you know, the whole northern part, the whole northern hemisphere, basically, is having this increase in thermodynamic activity. So that's what we know. That's what we know. You know, we got to continue watching these trends. But Irma was one of the biggest hurricanes in the history of the North Atlantic, one of the most powerful ever. You know, we don't want to jump. We don't want to jump the proverbial scientific gun, and we need to be proper and have scientific rigor, which means we have to take emotion. We have to take emotion out of the argument. You know, we got to be like Spock and think about it logically. All right, I got to cut the commercial.
Bonnie Las Charters is Mallorca's number one experience.
Bonnie Las is a 57-foot converted fishing boat. She was built in 1949 as a herring ringnetter in Scotland, and now she's set up for the Mediterranean. Apart from just relaxing in the sunshine on the deck, there's paddleboarding and any kind of exploring you can imagine up along the north coast of Mallorca here, quite often with Maggie the dog in tow as well. Bonnie Las Charters is unique because no charter is really the same. We work really hard to make it the perfect day for each individual client. To be able to go out and enjoy the day with the guests on board is just fantastic.
For more information and to make a booking, visit bonnielascharters.com.
This is Carolyn Sherlock from the Boat Galley. If you're going to the Annapolis Sailboat Show, October 5th to 9th, 2017, be sure to stop by and see me in booth M5. On the show map, it'll be listed as Lynn Pardee's booth, and yep, she'll be there too, as well as several others. It's going to be a great time. I can't wait to meet everybody.
Hello and welcome to Ocean Research Project. I am Matt Rutherford. It's probably been about a week now, 5-6 days at least, since I did that first segment. I usually don't have this much of a gap between segments, but it's been distracting lately. I've been having to write grants, and I don't know, there's just a whole lot of other stuff going on, both with, you know, selling lots of boats and trying to put together another expedition and writing grants for the expedition. Puerto Rico is still without power. I guess John McCain's trying to do something with the Jones Act, basically make it easier for freighters to get into Puerto Rico with water and fuel and supplies. They lifted the Jones Act for Harvey and Irma-related freighters, I guess. So they should do the same thing for Puerto Rico. I really don't understand. I don't know. I mean, the way I look at it is if we were in a war, we'd be fighting side by side with these guys, you know. It doesn't matter. Like, the whole race issue really shouldn't even be, like, we shouldn't even look at it in that, in a perspective that way. Like, you know, we're all Americans, and we all fight together if it came down to it, and we all die together if it came down to it. So we should just look out for each other, and we shouldn't be breaking people up into boxes, and the categories and subcategories within categories. We should just be looking out for each other as a nation. But anyways, yeah. And I made a mistake. I listened to the first segment I did. I said 7 billion when I talked about hurricane typhoon damage annually. It's not 7 billion. It's $700 billion a year in damages due to hurricanes and typhoons, and not 7. So, but, you know, I often do this sort of stuff off the top of my head, and I get things all tripped up. But anyways, trying to write grants, trying to get funding, trying to get money, trying to fund another research expedition for next year up in the Arctic, working with NASA, doing more climate research. More of the same, but a little different. But, you know, the Greenland, I was looking for a while to do a research project in the Northwest Passage. However much I would love to do research in the Northwest Passage, and however much I'd love just to get back up in there again, reality is it's just not as important as what's going on in Greenland. And I say that, I mean, there's a lot of important stuff going on in Northwest Passage as far as climate research goes, but the one thing that Greenland has is the largest chunk of ice in the northern hemisphere. I mean, by far. By leaps and bounds, the Greenland ice cap is much bigger piece of ice than anywhere else. Basically, I've said this in a previous episode some time ago, but if you were to melt all the glaciers on Earth outside of Greenland and Antarctica, you'd add about a half a meter to sea level rise. If you melt the Greenland ice cap, you have 21 feet, 7 meters to sea level rise. So, you know, if you melt every other iceberg, every other glacier in the northern hemisphere, southern hemisphere, Antarctica has like 250 feet of sea level rise. So there's all sorts of potential issues there. Antarctica is protected by colder currents in a way that Greenland isn't. And Antarctica is actually, it's interesting. Antarctica has been growing in snow and ice in the last couple of years, minimally, it's not a big growth, but they've had a little spike in snow and ice, like in the central middle part of Antarctica. But the sort of edges of Antarctica, like the Antarctic Peninsula, big old chunks of ice are breaking off of it. There is actually, it was just in the news the other day, a massive chunk of ice broke off Antarctica. And so what that really means when you see that, because the articles usually don't describe it very well, you have just south of the tip of South America, just south of Cape Horn, you have the Antarctic Peninsula. And when I say just south, I mean 600 miles south. That's not that far, really. In sailing terms, 600 miles is not that far. So that Antarctic Peninsula is the furthest north point, and that is where the massive glacier system was that has mostly, well, I say mostly, but a good part of it has broken off. First, it was Larsen A that broke apart. That was a major glacier. Larsen B broke apart. Larsen C. If you remember seeing that the news things were like, there's a giant crack running across the glacier in Antarctica. It was all over the news. That's what this big chunk breaking off of now is, the little, you know, it has to do with that region, that area. And this whole Larsen glacial, this big giant glacier, massive thing, you know. And so although Antarctica is getting more snow in some places, it's still breaking up around the edges. And but anyways, Greenland, Greenland is important because of the Greenland ice cap and the potential to add to sea level rise globally. If it melts, it could add, you know, there's 21 feet. I don't think all 21 feet, if you melted the entire ice cap, I think you'll have some great lakes, you know, in Greenland. So you'll have a lot of sea level rise, but you're not going to have 21 feet of sea level rise because some of that water is going to get trapped in lakes. You're going to have like a massive inshore lake or multiple inshore lakes in Greenland. And then you'll have like probably 15 feet of sea level rise instead of 21. 15 feet is absolutely insane. I mean, it would just completely flood. I don't know. You know, it's going to take a while to get to that point. I want to think that we're not beyond redemption, too. You know, I want to think that we can still, you know, if we make changes. I know Neil deGrasse Tyson or Tyson deGrasse, whatever his name is. Neil, the super scientist, was saying the other day that, you know, maybe it's gone past a point of no return. I don't want to think that that's the case. And I think that, you know, we need to invest more in alternative energy sources, ultimately. But yeah, so I'm going to get into this story with Africa. I don't know how long this story is going to take to tell. And I want to give a little extra time to, I don't plan this out. I just start talking off the top of my head. And, you know, I forget things and whatever else, but anyways, okay, so we were, I was sailing from Annapolis to Europe, Africa, the Caribbean, and back. It was a 2-year single-handed trip, roughly 15,542 miles, if I remember correctly, Annapolis to Annapolis. And this was the precursor that led up to my trip around the Americas when I sailed alone around North and South America nonstop single-handed, which was 309 days alone in the ocean, 27,077 miles nonstop, which I'll be getting to at a different point in time. I was in Senegal last trying to get a Kora built for my dad and hanging out with Racine Jabate. You want to hear some good Kora music, listen to Google. Google Toumane Jabate. And Jabate is not spelled like you think it is. I know that doesn't help, but I think it starts with a D. Yeah, Toumane Jabate. I don't know. I can't barely spell the word spell. But you'll find him. There, you know, he's famous. There's not many. Oh, yeah, you want to hear the best Kora music? Google Toumane Jabate New Ancient Strings. It's with him and Bakidiseku. They team up on that album. Then there's a lot of good stuff. VX Fakatore, Alex Fakatore, Jeliba, Mwasa Kunate. There's a lot of good music in West Africa. But anyway, so I leave out of Senegal. I've been single-handed for the most part up to this point. I had Whitney with me for a little while, but she left in Basque Country in the north coast of Spain. So Yanni had been riding his bicycle from Berlin to South Africa, trying to get to the World Cup in South Africa that year, 2009, and to watch the Germans. And we took this last-minute guy, Bruno, on board the boat. And so we're sailing down to Gambia. Bruno is seasick and flipping useless. He's like 23, 22, and me and Yanni are both like 29 or 30. I think Yanni might have been a year older than me, but Yanni was a virgin. He wasn't the 40-year-old virgin. He was the 30-year-old virgin. God, we used to bust his balls about that one. But nicest guy you could ever meet. Toughest guy you could ever meet. Nicest, toughest guy. How's that for a combination? Yanni was German. You know, he was born and raised around Berlin. And he's like the last guy in the world you'd want to fight a war against. And he was super pacifist. He was like the most pacifist guy ever. You know, he made a Quaker look, you know, violent. You know what I'm saying? So, but at the same time, you could drop a brick on this dude's foot and, you know, he wouldn't even say ouch. You know, he was just tough, like tough as nails. Tough, you know? And he was also tall and Aryan looking. But like, he was obviously, whatever. I mean, he was, you know, he was the ideal German specimen, I guess. But nicest guy, though. And, you know, absolute pacifist. But anyway, so I got this guy with me, and I got Bruno, who's a bit of a semi-useless young French kid who grew up in Marseille in southern France. Nice enough guy, too, but he was bumbling, and he was clumsy, and he was prone to seasickness. And he would spend money he didn't have and wind up, and he'd have no money, and he just, I don't know, he like needed a babysitter or something. So, okay, we're sailing to Gambia. Now that I've laid the backdrop here. We go in the Gambia River into the mouth from the ocean, and there's a port there. You know, first you're passing by these beaches on either side, and you're coming in the inlet. There's very little channel markers. There's very little infrastructure. You see people like beaching boats on the beach, and they're very primitive looking boats. Kids and people running around in buildings that are, you know, with rebar sticking out in all directions. And but everybody's looking very happy and generally speaking, you know, and you're working your way in this inlet. And turn off to starboard and go on a little ways, and you come to the port. The port is a flipping joke. It's a couple of concrete, and they're big concrete piers to deal with, like, small freighters. There's not a lot of activity in Gambia. I mean, it's the smallest country in West Africa. The streets in their capital are literally dirt roads. So, I mean, they don't got much money. So I didn't know where the hell to go, and I looked at this, and it's kind of busy looking for being what it was, you know? I mean, there's Gambian dudes all shirtless, looking holes in their pants, working their ass off, loading random cargo by hand onto these busted up looking small freighters. I mean, you don't feel like going over there and docking. So I dropped the hook and rode over there with Yanni and Bruno and to check in. And so I made a crucial mistake. And right in the beginning, this guy pulls me aside, and you know, this Gambian official, he was probably like late 40s, a heavy set Gambian dude. He had a better life than most people. He was an official. And he was like, yeah, okay, basically trying to get me to bribe him. He wanted like the equivalent of like $8-$9 in Gambian money. And so, and I'm just being, you know, I'm such a stubborn son of a bitch. I'm stubborn when I shouldn't be sometimes, you know? And I had this complex of like, I'm not going to pay any bribes, and nobody's going to bribe me, and nobody's going to push me around, and blah, blah, blah. Well, I should have paid him the $8-$9 because it took 2 days to check into that country. I had to run here, run there. I mean, and I know this guy made it more complicated. He like made a couple of phone calls and like, check out this American. I was the only sailor dude checking in. You know, nobody sails to this country, so I was the only guy there. You know, it's not like I could blend in with anybody else. So anyways, I go through this thing, and it takes a couple days. The last thing I had to do was get this river permit. It was a really weird experience. I went to like the third or fourth story of this building, this government building, and I was waiting to, I was paying to get a permit to go up the Gambia River, and this lady, cop, I don't know what you would call her. She was an official. She had a uniform and a badge. I don't know what her position was. But anyways, we're bullshitting. Because English is the national language of Gambia. Thank God I'm back in a country that I can freaking talk to somebody. Last time I was in a country where I could actually have a conversation was freaking Ireland. And I could understand the people better in Gambia than I could in Ireland. I was in West Ireland almost the whole time, and I would go into bars in West Ireland where they only spoke Gaelic. I mean, they wouldn't even speak English. Although, you know, you go far enough up the river in Gambia and they stop speaking English, they speak tribal language. But anyways, long freaking and short side of the story is I'm sitting here talking to this lady, you know, bullshitting about going up the river, and she printed me off some real, like, super primitive charts that, like, she printed from a printer. I basically didn't have any charts for going up this. It was very, very loose, sketchy charts for going up. You know, I was going to go a couple hundred miles up this river. And she starts telling me these stories about baboons raping women. And it just seemed like the strangest conversation to have. And she just went off for like 45 minutes. I'm waiting for this guy to come back with my passport. You know, he took my passport. He took my money. He's going off to like, I don't know, whatever he's got to do so I can get this permit to go up the river. And the entire time, this lady is telling me, and this lady's like in her mid-40s, and she's heavy set, and she's a very friendly lady, but I had no idea baboons rape people, and it just seemed like the strangest conversation. I actually heard that the Romans used to use baboons at the end of the Colosseum era, because in the Colosseum, it got crazier and crazier as time went on. They had to keep outdoing themselves, like I guess like pornography has just gotten crazier and crazier. It's the same sort of thing. And eventually, the Romans were actually having women getting raped by baboons in the Colosseum, which is completely insane. And apparently, it happened in Gambia. And I spent 45 minutes having this very wonderful, heavy-set lady in her mid-40s in her badge and uniform telling me all about how you better... I guess I didn't have to watch out, but how women have to watch out in Gambia because they might get sexually assaulted by a baboon. It was a very interesting way to check into that country. Anyways, I got to go to commercial.
I'm John Herlig. In Postcards from Sea, I tell stories of my travels aboard Ave Del Mar, my 1967 Rawson cutter. I deal with serious nautical issues like how to sail your mast into a tree on a canal, what kind of incense best covers the aroma of kimchi fermenting on your boat, or whether or not I can beat a leukemia patient at a video game. It's simply the story of my life, and my life happens to take place on a 50-year-old sailboat with no particular destination in mind. I hope you'll join me and some of the wonderful characters I meet as I travel for my show, Postcards from Sea, every other Monday here on Boat Radio.
Time goes forward, go and catch your jet. You will find your moment. Time goes forward. Stay and have a sneeze. Let's dream about the future.
Our aim at Street Invest is to put a trustworthy adult into the lives of street children so that they can support them in creating the most positive paths for their lives in the future. We work around the world, working on the street with the children where they are. For such a large group of children, the amount of funding available is tiny. Really, the funding that keeps organisations like Street Invest going comes from individual donors. Street children are the most abused, neglected, violated children, yet they are also the most resourceful, responsive, and resilient children that we could have the honour of working with.
For more information or to make a donation, visit streetinvest.org.
This is Bob Bitchin from Cruising Outpost Magazine, and I love listening to Boat Radio.
Hello, and welcome back to Ocean Research Project. I am Matt Rutherford. I had to move locations a bit. I'm in a house with no air conditioning. Believe it or not, there's no air conditioning. About 20 minutes south of Annapolis, and so all the windows are open, and the neighbor started mowing their lawn right next to the windows, and so I am now in a bedroom with a mattress on the floor, and hopefully you can't hear the lawnmower. So anyways, I'm back in Gambia. I got all my papers, I got it all worked out, spent a couple days, ran through a bunch of hoops, should have bribed the guy $8. It probably would have all happened in an hour if I did that, and so whatever. I wanted to go to this place called Laman Lodge. I didn't know much about it. Turned out to be an incredible place. So you leave out of the capital, and I mean, it's right next to it. And you go into the mangroves, and it's like there's a channel, but there's not very good markers, really. And it shoals up real bad on either side. So you got to stay in the channel, but you don't know where the channel is exactly, so you're just doing your best. You work your way into the mangroves, and now you're like in a labyrinth. Like, the mangroves are like a crazy labyrinth. And you turn to port at first, work your way in, but there's a fork in the road and another fork in the road, and eventually you start seeing masts, you know, and then you're like, all right, there's the masts. I got to keep turning towards that direction. But it is a bit confusing. You get back in there, you drop a hook, a few other boats on anchor. A lot of those boats, though, are just staying there for the season, and they pay West African people to look out for their boats. There's a better anchorage to do that at, and that's where they should be taking their boat to. There's an anchorage in Gambia where people just pay Gambians to look after their boats while they leave their boat there for however long they're gone for. Don't leave your fucking boat. Don't leave your boat in the transient anchorage. This is a transient anchorage. If you're going to be gone, leave your boat in the other anchorage. It's just proper etiquette. But anyways, Laman, you drop your hook. You're surrounded by mangroves. I don't remember mosquitoes being that bad. I don't remember there really being hardly any. It must have been the right time of year. You know, there's a dry season and wet season in that part of the world. And lower your dinghy. In my case, it was that stupid Avon Red Crest that... I hate to say stupid. I mean, it's a silly dinghy. But, you know, I never had to worry about anybody stealing it because it was such a piece of junk. I mean, it was inflatable all the way around. I had to row it. Anyways, you go pull into Laman Lodge. Laman Lodge is like something out of Robinson Crusoe. You know, this like three-story bamboo hut thing. It looks like Robinson Crusoe meets Southeast Asia meets West Africa. I mean, it's like, I don't know, it's hard to explain. It's really pretty. You get up in there, there's spider monkeys everywhere, man. Spider monkeys will drink your beer. They'll drink your Coke. They'll steal your food. You know, you got to be careful of them spider monkeys. They got too used to people. And Laman is not too far away. Laman was a cool place. It's about a town of about 2,000 people. So I'm in there. I'm in this town. I'm with Yanni and Bruno. Yanni goes off to try to find the bar. You know, we try to get a beer. There's some beers at Laman, but at Laman Lodge, they're kind of expensive, to be honest, man. They're like twice of what they should be. So we got to find a local beer. We got to find a local place to have a beer. So Yanni goes out there, and I don't remember what the hell I'm doing. Stuff on the boat, working on the boat, whatever, normal stuff. And Yanni comes back a bit later, and he's like, "Yeah, I have found the chicken, man," or something like that. I'm not very good at the German accent. And he found the chicken man. I'm like, what is the chicken man? You know, what the hell are you talking about? And he's like, "Yeah, the chicken man knows where to find the bar," or something. And so I'm like, all right. So we load up in the Avon Red Crest and row our ass to Laman Lodge, tie off, walk through Laman Lodge. Usually there's a musician on your right-hand side, some dude playing some instrument like a kora or some drums, and, you know, trying to get like a tip or something. So you throw them a coin when you pass. The people who work in Laman Lodge are poor people from freaking the town of Laman. Nice ass people. You say what's up, and off you go to see the chicken man. So we find the chicken man, and we buy a chicken from him. He's like, yeah, you know, I am the chicken man, and he had a lot of chickens. He was the chicken man. I mean, literally, had a bunch of freaking chickens. So I bought a chicken from him, which he promptly picked up and broke its neck right in front of me, which is fine. I mean, whatever. I mean, I'm glad he did it and not me. I don't remember. I gave him like $1, $2, something like that. And then he told us how to get to the bar. So we continue on our way, walking through these paths, coming through Laman, this town of Laman. Little kids see you because we're on these back road, like dirt road trails. Cutting between, they got compounds. That's how they roll in Gambia. And I imagine they roll like this in a lot of Africa. They got flipping compounds. That's what, you don't got a house. You got a compound. And that means you got like fortifications, you know. You got infrastructure. You got walls. You're like you're like what Agamemnon was trying to take out in Troy. Yeah. And how big you can make your walls and how heavy duty you can make them is like all part of the stature, you know. And, you know, the more poor people got smaller walls. The people with more money got like freaking giant tall walls. Inside the compound, you got one house, two house, three house. Very basic, infrastructures, some kit, a common cooking area, an area with chickens and shit running around. You know, that's how they do it. So yeah, anyways, we roll up to the zoo bar. It was called the zoo bar because it was next to the zoo, but the zoo had closed down, so the zoo was abandoned. So it was just, it was the zoo bar next to the abandoned zoo. And they had two tables out front. It wasn't a bar. It was really a convenience store with two tables out front. It was like a cinder block, a little tiny cinder block thing with a couple of tables. And the beer there was like half the price as it was at Laman Lodge. And they had Ja Brew, which is the local beer. And you get the Ja Brew with a crocodile on it, because that shit is like twice as strong. It's just like 7% alcohol. And why not? It's the same price. You don't have to do as much sipping, and you don't got to do as much pissing. And it's just mathematics. So we were hanging out there, and some of the other... Now, Gambia is Muslim, and a lot of Muslim countries don't drink alcohol. But West Africans are sort of a little more liberal Muslim, I guess you could say. And nowhere in the Quran does it say anything about you can't drink alcohol. That wasn't in the book. That was just some imam, some priest, who made that up later on. So it's not in the Quran anyways. But most of them don't drink that much. So to be honest with you, there was a small Christian contingency within Laman. Out of 2,000 people, maybe 200 were Christian. So we would sit in this bar, and... usually it was the Christian people who drank would go there. Sometimes it was the Muslim dudes. There wasn't that many people who could do it, because probably not many could afford it, even though the beer was half price. And it was right by the side of the road. I remember one night this dude from the UN, he had a UN vehicle. He was just some Gambian dude. And we all sat around and got trashed. We hung out in Laman for a little while, maybe like 4 or 5 days. Before we went south. And we went to the zoo bar like every night, and we'd meet up with basically the same characters, you know, the same people hanging out there, the same like dozen people, because there's only two tables, you know. Not like you can, not, there weren't that many people that I guess they could afford, I don't know. But we go down this trail, we get it was crazy. We're with this UN dude in a UN vehicle, and me and Yanni, Bruno wasn't there that night. And we've all been drinking. It's like 2, 3 in the morning. Like, we've been drinking, like, sitting there bullshitting and talking about God knows what for hours. And he's like, let's go, I don't remember, let's go find another bar, because this bar was closing. So we pile up in the UN vehicle. We're going down these. He's like, I know a shortcut. And we'd, like, turn off into this dirt road through, like, the jungle, through fields. There's, like, not even a dirt road. It's a shortcut. And I'm thinking, like, what? You know, like, we're about to, I don't know what we're about to, like, we're driving through fields with grass that's, like, 5 feet tall. Like, we are making a trail, you know, with this, and it's, like, 3 a.m, and we're all, I mean, it was a good time, and I was just going with it. And the funny thing is, boom, he pops back out on the road exactly, you know, he knew where he was going. He had done it before, and just not recently, I guess. So, anyways, spend some time in Laman, hang out with the locals, drink some beer in the day, go hang out in Laman Lodge with the spider monkeys, you know, earlier, and work on the boat, get things ready, get charts, get, you know, we're going to go up the river. And we had, you know, it's damn near 200 miles to go up there. I wanted to get everything sorted out before we left. And we head out down the river. The river gets more narrow. Initially, it starts off salt. It becomes more and more fresh as you go up the river. It's sort of like you sail up into the jungle. And I use the term sailing pretty lightly. It's pretty motor intensive. You know, you need your engine. You motor sail when you can. So, yeah, we went up a ways, I don't know, 30, 40, 50 miles. And I was feeling extra adventurous. We start going down creeks. We went down the Bintang Creek, which goes like 40 miles with a general depth of 6 feet or more. And so we went like, I don't know, 15 miles up. We went to the town of Bintang, this little town, and you get mobbed by kids, of course. When you know, we show up in our Avon Red Crest. I drop my, you know, my Pearson, freaking drop the hook off the shoreline. in the little river. Well, really, just drop it in the middle of the river. Ain't no other traffic in the Bintang Creek besides me. I was the only boat with an engine. You know, they got little dugouts, like little trees and whatnot that they dug out, like literal dugouts. And they row those things fast. They got these spade-looking paddles, and they row fast as hell with these things. But, yeah, we met Big Bo from Bintang, hung out with him and his friends in this hut, and had a good time, really. Just drank with them, drank some really rock-gut stuff. And they were smoking ganja with more seeds than weeds. I mean, it was just like... But, you know, whatever. It was fun. Had a good time. And sang some songs that I didn't know what the hell I was singing. And danced around a bit and played the drums. And had a serious hangover the next morning. But had a good time in Bintang with Big Bo and his friends. And continued on down the river. And, yeah, I mean, normally... There was one cut, you know, the Gambia River really isn't that difficult to go up, and I would suggest it. It's an incredible, Gambians are incredibly nice and friendly. I never locked my boat once the entire time I was there. I never worried about it. Now, if there was a lot more tourist activity, then eventually the locals would learn that you could steal from the boats, and then maybe it would become an issue. But when you don't have a lot of tourist activity, and it's you got one or two situations... One situation is you're going to be completely robbed with everything. Like if you pulled into Sierra Leone and decided to go up some random creek. Maybe Sierra Leone's a bad example. All I know is it was bad at one time. I'm not sure the current status of their ports there. I'm not trying to shit on Sierra Leone. I can't even flippin' say it correctly. Anyways, there's either the situation where it's going to be really, really bad, or the situation where they're just not used to other boats, and they just leave you alone. And that's what it's like in Gambia. They just leave you alone. And anyways, I don't got a lot of time left, I need enough time to tell the story of us actually going up the Gambia River and back down again, and all the crazy mishaps from that situation. So yeah, oceanresearchproject.org, working on a new website. It's going to be another month or two, but it is, well, hopefully not that long. Trying to put together another expedition. There's videos from last year up on the website. If you're looking for a boat, David Walters Yacht Sales, let me know. I can help you find the right boat for you, depending on whatever it is you want to do and however much money you got, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, you guys have a good one, and until next time.
When you're ready to escape, but your boat's not ship shape, that's okay. Skipper's review will get you on your way. Marina's mechanics, satellites, and crew. SkippersReview.com will find it for you. Friends will tell you which ones to use in just a few words with their glowing reviews. SkippersReview.com, where boaters know best and businesses pass the test.
A quick reminder, I'll be at the Annapolis Sailboat Show in booth M5 with Lynn Pardee and others. Stop by. I want to meet you.
With a plan to expand my vision. Yeah, it's either this or it's prison. I'm trying to be free and expand my wisdom. I gotta tell my story. I did it for the journey, the glory. Many men tried way before me. I had to do it bigger cause I had to make history. From the streets to the sea, far away, not a soul did I see. From Chesapeake up to Baffin Bay, my motto is hard work first and laugh and play. Now let's take a trip through the Northwest Passage. Some say I got a problem, I say it's a passion. I'm just trying to reach my goals before passing, and I'ma do what I wanna do without asking. It's my life, my right, so I fight for my dreams. No matter how hard it might seem, this is my pipe dream. My advice to get your mind right, find light and do the right thing. No matter the weather or whatever the night brings, thunder and lightning, it's enlightening. Lost in the abyss, I can't even begin to explain how awesome this is. I've been all around the world and back around the world to find
myself to reach my goals, to find my dreams when I'm away, to wash away. I explore, I've been all around the world and back around the world to find myself, to reach my goals, to find my dreams when I'm away, to wash away. I explore, I've been all around the world and back, all around the world and back, all around the world and back. I've been all around the world and back, world and back, world and back. Been all around the world and back, all around the world and back, all around the world and back. I've been all around the world and back, world and back, world and back.
For gold, it was a mission to get rich. I do it for soul. They thought that I was a misfit, it would probably fall. But I'm the type to go the distance and finish the brawl. They said that it was suicide, that I would die for sure. But I was like the prince of tide in the eye of a storm. Yo, the great waves, they send sailors crashing. You're on the map, I'm on the face of the atlas. Thousands of miles away, I'm trying to see the world while you sit at home, probably doing the same thing. The fact that you don't want to get out and explore is a damn shame. It's either you're too lazy to do it or you just can't hang. Trend set up, major sailor, the vendetta, breaking the world record, no one can do it better. There's so much in the world you must see, and you can make a big difference, just you and me. I've been all around the world and back, around the world, to find myself, to